In the matter of U.S. Masters Residential Property versus DEP, may we please have appearances of counsel? Welcome, counsel. Mr. Lesper.
May it please the court. Superstorm Sandy ravaged New Jersey on October 29th, 2012. The storm affected each and every one of us, but this case is about a corner of working-class Bayonne at the 22nd Street and Avenue F, where beyond mere flooding, the real damage was the discharge of hazardous substances, that is, oil, which was obvious to those who responded in the days and weeks that followed. It was obvious to the Bayonne Police Department, which conducted search and rescue operations and reported wading into waters that were contaminated by oil and petrochemicals. It was obvious to the press covering the story, which described the oil residue, which described as smelly sludge visible on cars and buildings, making them uninhabitable. It was obvious even to DEP, which inspected the very area here at issue, declaring it an immediate environmental concern, describing it as heavily oiled, noting that oil had migrated from nearby property during Sandy, calling it oily runoff, and requiring $15,000 of power washing by way of immediate remediation. It was obvious in an inspection in early December, a short time later, noting the presence of oil, and it was obvious mostly in the notes that you have in the record before you, referring to the entire incident as the Hurricane Sandy Bayonne oil spill. It was even obvious to the spill fund administrator who, even as he said that the majority of the damages incurred were directly due to floodwaters, admitted that there was oil in those floodwaters, particularly in the area of the properties, and that there was a discharge of hazardous substances on 22nd and Avenue F. It was certainly obvious to the owners who reported, who examined the property just within days and reported that it looked and smelled like oil in the immediate aftermath. And it was obvious to the expert that was retained by U.S. Masters who detected that oil immediately, described it in graphic terms that are in the record before you, including the strong odor of oil, and who concluded that there had been pollution by petroleum.
So it wasn't obvious to the ALJ. Where did he go wrong?
Well, he went wrong in two ways, and that what makes this case an interesting and important one is those two ways. One of those is substantive, and the other of those is procedural. The substantive one is that at the end of the day, all of what I've just described was fundamentally ignored by the ALJ in favor of a single test for aliphatics, which he concluded showed that there was no oil in one particular place. Procedurally, and really what's in some ways the most disturbing about this case, is that he didn't allow a full airing of the record. And he didn't allow full airing of the record in a context, Your Honor, in which I want to continue to use sports metaphors here and say it was a moving of the goalposts. Let's think about what happened here. Immediately in the aftermath, DEP's response is that this is not a post Spill Act discharge, because it was historic fill. That was the theory from the very first, it was the basis for the initial denial, which occurred on July 2nd, 2013. There was an amended denial 6 months later. There's numerous continuances, adjournments, requested largely by DEP. The case goes to trial on February 1st, 2016. On January 11th, 2016, for the first time, DEP posits an entirely different theory. Not that this was on historic fill, which it couldn't be for reasons I'll describe in a moment, but now it was DAP, that is air pollution, diffuse anthropogenic pollution, I'm very pleased with myself for getting these terms down. It's not what I usually do. I was more, would have been more comfortable in this morning's arguments. So now, on the eve of trial, literally, after all this time, and arguably out of time, DEP comes up with this new theory. And that new theory is, within weeks, rebutted by a report produced by U.S. Masters showing that there's, in fact, oil inside the building.
Okay, stop right there, though. Right. Is that report in this record now? Because it was stricken, and Dr. Brown's testimony also appears to have been stricken about the substance of that report. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. And I should note, in the appellate division, U.S. Masters counsel attempted to put that report before the court as part of the record, so at least the court could evaluate it. Mm-hmm. And DEP opposed it, and it was not allowed.
But I did notice in the briefing there seemed to be an assertion by your side, your client, mm-hmm. that the report provided conclusive proof that there was oil present in the testing results. Is that correct?
It does. I have the report, and it was a report that should have been part of the record so that the court could assess the damage.
So my question to you is, at the ALJ level, mm-hmm. even when you're denied admission of a report, then you have it marked, okay, and preserved. I'm moving this onto the record for further review. That's the way you're supposed to do it. Was that done?
I don't know, Your Honor, whether it was marked. It was the court had it. The parties had it. Whether it was actually marked with an exhibit number, I don't know. I agree with the court that it should have been made a part of the record for this court's review today. That would make this.
And I don't see it. And I don't see it in your brief. I was looking, since there was such a big deal about this. Mm-hmm. I was wondering whether or not you were going to press this in your brief before this court. But I didn't see anything about the rebuttal brief. Am I?
Well, we summarize it. I mean, in just the way you've described.
No, but do you have a point in your brief in which you're claiming it was error for the ALJ not to admit the rebuttal? Is that in your brief?
Yes.
Yeah. Where?
Our whole point is that
isn't that your argument about the arbitrator that this report was a response to the late report by the NJDP and that was allowed but this wasn't?
Correct.
Wasn't that raised?
Yes, it was.
I thought I read it.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. It absolutely was raised. Yes.
So point. I just want to make certain I'm not missing something. Yeah. This is in your petition. You challenged the failure of the court to allow the rebuttal in?
Correct. Okay. Yeah, so we challenged two things. We challenged a number of things, but one of the arguments that we made is that the ALJ erred by allowing in the state's expert so late, and the other procedural argument that we raised was that, and particularly having done that, that it erred by not allowing U.S. Masters to put in its report. If I had it to do over again, I would make some sort of application to this court to allow that report, and I'll consider this an oral application, to allow that court, the court to have access to that for purposes of this. I was concerned about adding something that was not in the record, and particularly something that, as you pointed out, had been not allowed, stricken, and then in the appellate division particularly was not allowed in. So that's the reason why you don't have it before you. With leave of the court, I'm more than happy to provide it. It will be
Let's not go there unless the clerk asks you for it.
I got it. But I will say that it is as represented. But just think about the process for a second. Even without knowing exactly what that report says, here's what you know from the record before you. What you know is that there's a notice of intent that has a particular theory. That theory is historic fill, that this is pre-spill act, this is a pre-spill act fill. Upon examination, the record shows that theory begins to fall apart. In fact, this property is not on top of spill, and in fact, naphthalene, which is the hazardous substance at issue, is not the type of thing that appears, not surprisingly, in spill. So, that having been rebutted over months and months and months, a month before trial, the state comes up with a new theory, which is that it came down from the sky, that it was this DAP,
But wasn't it related to the emissions from trucks in the area? That's what they said that DAP came from?
That's their argument.
And wouldn't that be historic, fall within the parameters of historic, because it was ongoing for so long?
Yeah. So I think that's an interesting question that was not briefed or argued here as to whether that would be a discharge. Let's assume for the moment that that would be historic. I think it's a little bit hard to understand how that would, because it's happening at the same time. But
no, they said it can't. To follow up on that question, part of the testimony was some of those carbon emissions could have been from 100 years ago. And they've all settled. No? Am I mistaken about that?
No, you're right. They could have been. I mean, look, I'm not an environmental lawyer or an expert in this, but what ends up being the theory that the ALJ goes off on is not even that the naphthalene came down from the skies, but that it came down on the land, that it came down into the ocean, it settled in the sludge, it was churned up and flooded Bayonne. The problem with that is that the DEP's own expert said that that's not what DAP does. He talked about in his testimony how he had done studies of these exact waterways, and that typically what DAP does is it stays either on the surface or just below the surface of the waters. It doesn't go down as far as the silt at the bottom. So that the very finding that the ALJ makes in an effort to show that this is historic spill is the historic fill, is the equivalent, right, that it's pre-spill act, right, was not a reasonable inference from the evidence before him. It was rebutted by the state's own experts. So we really are dealing here with the goalposts being moved twice, once right before the trial and once after the trial is over.
Well, as to the latter point, that was the substantive error that you claim the ALJ made. Mm-hmm. You took the discussion of Dr. Staken about this particles that get mixed up from the silt and mixed up in the water when he was describing the silt on the interior of the walls. Mm-hmm. And the ALJ did not seem to realize that then he moved back to the testing of the samples that were taken outside of the yard, and he incorporated the testimony about the doctor's explanation of what he perceived on the walls of the interior to what he was finding outside in the borings. Is that correct?
That really is correct, but the outside is where there's this naphthalene that's found.
Correct.
And
that's where he mixed the theories.
Where he mixes them up.
So assume that you're correct. Take the DAP theory and put it to one side. Mm-hmm. We still have a series of findings by the ALJ, and what I'd like you to do is tell us what's left of them, because he finds that oil was not detected at the site, that olfactory and visual tests did not reveal it, and that there was no analytical testing that revealed it. What's left of those findings?
The first and third of those would be rebutted by the report that he didn't allow in. Keep in mind, and this is very important, the finding of naphthalene was from a site outside in the yard. The testing that was done thereafter, directly in response to the DEP's testing, had to do with what was inside the units, on the walls, on the floors, etc. All of that.
You said thereafter. I want to make certain, in the rebuttal or
in the rebuttal
that we don't have before us.
That you don't have before you.
Mm-hmm. And how are you even talking about it then?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about it. I mean, what? Here's what you know. What you know is that on the eve of trial, the state serves an expert report, and what you know is that the ALJ refuses to allow, even though that report is so late in the game, long after discovery is closed. Even though the court allows that in over objection, then when U.S. Masters attempts to put in its own report, which you write, you don't have, so you don't know the
substance. Part of the problem is caused by your side, because you didn't make the appropriate proffer. The proffer would have been, okay, Your Honor, you're keeping it out. For the record, I'm stating this is what's in the report for further appellate review. The thing that you cannot tell us right now.
It's not, respectfully, that's not quite the error. You're close, but it's not quite there. Because
tell me where I missed it.
Okay, that all of that was before the ALJ.
It's not all in the record, is it? There was a telephone conference?
No. There's oral argument. It's in the record. But I can represent that the report was provided to counsel. It was characterized on the record, and the court, the ALJ had that report. Yeah.
But there's a reference to a telephone conference. There's a reference, as sometimes happens in the informality of arbitration proceedings, there's a reference to things that had been discussed before and reasons that were previously given. You're asking us to find that the ALJ, who has enormous latitude over discovery, abused his discretion when he granted your adversaries, or permitted your adversaries' late report and denied the rebuttal report. How do we possibly have a record for that? Because there is this you know, vague reference to some information that had been provided to the ALJ before.
Yeah, I mean, here's what I can show you and what I can't show you. I think you have plenty of record enough to show to conclude that it was an abuse of discretion, just based on the timing and based on what you know, which is that the last report, the one that was allowed in from the state, was in fact a shift of theory.
So if that's true, then we would be essentially saying, no matter why an arbitrator does so, it is an abuse of discretion for the arbitrator to allow in a report a few days before the beginning of the arbitration, but not allow a rebuttal report that comes in during the arbitration. Yeah, that would be the rule. If we don't know we have nothing further.
I don't think it has to be that broad. I think that there's several aspects of what occurred here that make this unique. And here's what they are. First of all, his denial, I agree, Justice Patterson, totally agree with the idea that the standard of review is abuse of discretion. There's no question. Here's why this is an abuse of discretion. If at the very end, U.S. Masters had attempted to get in an expert report and the ALJ said, no, I'm not allowing it, I think that would be legitimately could be called a discretionary call that should be affirmed. Mm-hmm. But what's unique here is he does that immediately after allowing such an untimely report by the state. That is, discretion is discretion, and it's appropriate, but it has to be even-handed.
When you have situations happening, and it happens in trials as well, but you're dealing with an arbitration where there is a lot of discretion, a lot of scheduling and procedural discretion, mm-hmm. as you know, mm-hmm. that is afforded to the ALJ. Mm-hmm. So obviously, the late rebuttal report is often something that people come up with and you know, for maybe have very good reasons to do in response to a late served expert's report. So you're saying that makes it unique. I would say that happens a lot.
I think what's disturbing here is two aspects. One aspect is the uneven-handedness of it. I would get if the court at the beginning of January, on January 11th, just 3 weeks before the trial were to begin, would say, I'm not taking any more reports. But to allow the state's report, which says something entirely new,
Is that your argument, that it's a brand new cause of action that the state raises, or a new defense? If it had been the same defense, you wouldn't have even needed your rebuttal report?
That's correct.
This is a new defense that was brought in at that late in the game. You weren't so you're preparing for a different defense, and then you obtain a quick report to rebut that. Had it been the same original defense, you wouldn't have even needed a rebuttal.
I think that's very significant, and it's a very important part of it. It's not all of it, but it's a very important part of it.
I think that's a very powerful argument. So let me tell you what my holdup mm-hmm. is. Since I don't have the rebuttal report, we don't have the rebuttal report, we can't determine whether or not, for reasons other than the lateness of the rebuttal report, it was kept out because it was third-hand hearsay, or what all the other reasons where the ALJ would be within his discretion to keep the rebuttal report out.
So the ALJ gives three reasons for keeping the report out. None of them, based on the record you have before you, involved a careful balancing of what was in the report, which he doesn't even mention or accept or address, versus its lateness and so forth. So he keeps it out based on grounds of lateness. He keeps it out on grounds of hearsay, which is really extraordinary, both because hearsay is allowed in these proceedings and had been allowed with all the identical other reports.
I'm going based on my memory right now that certain of the, he didn't even know who wrote some of the reports. They weren't signed. Am I off about that?
Not this report and not the plaintiff's reports. Sure. I'm challenged here because you're asking me questions about a report that's not before you. But what?
No. I'm just talking about what the ALJ said as some of his reasons for keeping it out. He said that the person who was submitting it was not the author, and some, if I remember correctly now, and you'll correct me, and that some of the pages of the report weren't signed, so he didn't even know who the author was. Yeah. Am I off about that?
You're really not. I mean, he kept it out because it's based on lab results that were not lab results that were done by the testifying expert, by Mr. Brown, who was the expert. That was one of the bases. But of course, that was true throughout. It's often the case that lab results are testified to and are presented by some expert who actually didn't do the lab testing. And prior reports were allowed in this case that had precisely the same features. And so it sort of came out of the blue in that regard. And then his other analysis is kind of a 403 analysis about how the prejudice, and it'll be prejudicial, it'll take up time.
We said he was not prepared by your expert.
Which is true.
And was therefore hearsay. Portions not signed by anyone, as Justice Alvin noted. Yep. Other portions signed by people who are not in before the arbitrator to testify. DEP needed substantial time to prepare a response, and samples could have been taken over the preceding 3 years,
right. And
this report didn't have to be quite as light.
Right.
Those are really the combination of factors. And obviously, there are arguments can be made about each one of those, but we're talking about a standard that affords significant discretion on these procedural issues, in part to save the parties the money that would be spent and the resources that would be wasted on constantly going appealing these issues. There's a lot of discretion here.
Yeah. Well, Your Honor, I don't know that there would be constant appeals, but again, what I would emphasize is I think that makes a lot of sense in a situation where you haven't just allowed in a report that goes in a totally different direction, as Justice Fernandez-Vina said, from what had existed before.
But that's doesn't that happen a lot?
I don't think
people come up with rebuttal reports are often engendered by a new theory that the defense expert...
And if this had been a situation where months earlier there had been a report, so this case was originally scheduled for trial in May of 2015, if prior to that the state had done a report that said exactly what this one said, and it wasn't until a couple of days before the trial that U.S. Masters had provided its report, I could see that argument. But to allow in a late report then, and by the way, in some ways, what's the rush? I mean, this report comes in, is provided on a month before the trial proceedings ended. There would have been plenty of time for the state to review it, respond to it, and get before that court, the whole picture. In which case, what would be before this court would be the whole picture, and we probably wouldn't even be here.
Speak to the last reason that Justice Patterson read for us, the fact that there had been several years in which lab results could have been obtained. We understand your argument that the theory shifted. Why, aside from that, was no lab report prepared in the prior 3 years?
Because it wasn't needed. Because during that time, there were lab reports that were prepared. And those lab reports showed naphthalene on the property. Those lab reports from the time, from right after the spill until January of 2016 were unrebutted. So, and in addition to that, the evidence from my client's perspective was overwhelming. The observations were that there was oil all over the place, not only by...
Let's talk about the test results first. And I'm going to be not using the technical language.
No problem.
It seemed to me from the DEP's expert analyzing your test results that they fell in a level that required further testing, that they were basically inconclusive, that at a particular level they could be an oil spill or they could be DAP. And therefore, it required further testing, which at least you didn't do until the rebuttal.
Because we didn't get that report. I mean, again, if they had said that when they received our test results, that it required more testing, then this would be a different case. Then we would, it would be a very strong argument that all this time had gone by and we had never done additional testing. But that point is raised for the first time by the state, by the DEP, in January, on January 11th.
But they were always claiming that you didn't prove that there was an oil spill. That was at least their underlying premise, no?
Absolutely, that was their underlying premise.
So then you knew that you had the burden of showing there was an oil spill.
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. What we know we have to show is based upon the notices that we get. There's an NOI, Notice of Intent to Deny, that's provided, and they give us reasons. And by the way, under the regulations which we cite, they're required to give us reasons. They don't give us reasons out of the goodness of their heart, but they're not allowed to just stamp denied. They have to give us reasons. And then those reasons, and why do they give us reasons? So that we can submit a claim that addresses those reasons, so that we can then have an adversarial proceeding that takes on those reasons and attempts to rebut them.
Mr. Luxburg, in the December 2013 amended NOI,
mm-hmm.
in paragraph 7, where it talks about the staining of an unknown substance in the interior, the paragraph ends with a criticism of no laboratory analysis of the staining having been provided to determine whether the staining is related to a discharge of the hazardous substance. Why didn't that put you on notice that additional testing was required from that point forward?
It suggested, just like you for sure, that there should have been additional testing.
Mm-hmm.
But remember the state of the record. The state of the record is that there's other evidence that it's oil. And at the beginning of this, I said that there's fundamental issues, one of which is the shifting theory and the due process concerns. The other is that this court has always held that in the context of administrative proceedings or anything else, that courts are required to consider all of the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't that evidence considered that there was oil and the arbitrator discounted it because there was only eyewitness, there was nothing scientific, there was just someone saying, hey, look, that oil to me, it smelled like oil,
yeah.
And he determined that he would give that very little weight, if any.
Right.
Isn't that within his authority to determine the credibility of witnesses?
I don't think, I would agree if it was a matter of credibility of witnesses, but that's not what he said. If you look carefully, what he said is, I find that even if all of that's true, that the lack of analytic testing basically trumps that fact. I believe that this record stands solidly for the proposition that all of those olfactory and visual observations are irrelevant, and that should not be. In fact, I don't think it can be as a matter of law.
Has it ever been in the past? Have arbitration decisions from the spill fund relied on visual and olfactory observations before for findings?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, as to whether they have or haven't.
It seems
I can
like
tell you that no authority was cited for the proposition that a single set of analytic testing trumps all of those visual observations. In fact, the state...
But he said they were...
He said they were conflicting.
Yeah, because their people went out and said, I didn't smell it. And their people also said that a layperson might actually confuse oil with this DAP that's been dredged up and also some of the landfill, the odors, they can confuse it. So it seemed to me that the ALJ felt that there was like conflicting testimony on that subject. Am I mistaken?
You're not mistaken. The ALJ specifically found that there was conflicting testimony, but I would ask that the court look carefully at what that conflicting testimony was. The testimony from the claimant side, from U.S. Master side, was based on observations that occurred roughly contemporaneously with the events. The observations that the DEP officials made, the earliest is in March, almost some 5 months later. And the ones that they mainly rely are in January 2016. Their expert doesn't come to the site until early January of 2016, at which point it's winter, and smells are more muted during winter, and that seems to be accepted. I can tell you that's my view, and I think that's what you should accept.
You just play an expert on TV.
Yeah. I don't do that stuff. So
all factory senses are perfect.
Yes, this particular expertise of mine, having had kids, but remember, by the time even the first observation has now been this power washing that's occurred,
there was a fire.
There had been other leaks. Time had passed, but more to the point, we're talking about what occurred in October 2012. They go, the, some of these observations that he's relying on occur in January 2016, 38 months later. Respectfully, I know
didn't
that...
Didn't someone else go out? Did some, not just the expert, someone else from the DEP earlier went out? And did he say that he smelled oil?
So, as I said, in March of 2013, so closer in time, somebody from DEP goes out and says he doesn't smell or see it. Okay. It's hard to know exactly what he saw or smelled and you
but
know what he was relying upon.
You at least concede that the ALJ had conflicting testimony on the subject?
I think he had conflicting testimony, but I don't think, but I do think if you read carefully his decision, what he says is not an unresolvingness in favor of the DEP's testimony. He's not doing that. What he's doing is saying, in any event, what we needed was analytical testing. That's right in his opinion. I'll find it for.
And this is where maybe your rebuttal argument is your strongest, because it seemed to me from reading ALJ's decision that he was really on the edge, going like one way or the other. It seemed he was very close to the divide. Did you get that sense?
I don't know whether he was or wasn't really.
At least based upon what
he
wrote.
But so this really goes to the second reason why I think this does fall into that category of discretionary calls that deserve a second look by a court. Abuses of discretion could still potentially be abuses. That doesn't mean they're unreviewable. And here, in addition to the procedural problem, which I do think is very important in a situation where it's a close call, this court has a long tradition of not allowing this type of exclusion of evidence based upon a deadlines missed and so forth to get in the way of a fair, full adjudication of the merits. And respectfully, I think that's what happened here.
But there's no rule coming out of any decision, tell me if I'm wrong, that says that even in most of these cases involve trial judges, that any late report, period, has to be accepted. Because the trial judges have lots of discretion to say, look, we've had this opportunity, that opportunity, we had this discussion, we had that discussion. You don't find this court saying the search for truth is paramount over schedules and you must accept any expert report or rebuttal expert.
Nor is that the rule of law, Justice Patterson, that I would propose.
So what is the principle when we don't have the entire record with respect to this late served report? What's the principle that you want us to say? When you said that the case is unique, you talked about the timing.
No, I talked about the even-handedness. Though what bothers me about this case and what should bother you about this case is you don't really know what happened.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, you had a report. I mean, obviously, if a situation were presented where an arbitrator or ALJ or a trial judge said, I only want to hear an expert's report from one side because I like them better, that's a very uneven-handed, sort of obvious lack of even a fairness. But you had a report. You were the plaintiff. You have the burden. Your client submitted a report. There's a responding report that's late, but not right in the middle of trial, and that's accepted. And then there's a reply that's very late.
What's
the principle that doesn't allow the ALJ to accept the one and not the other?
The principle that this court has always embraced is simply a vague one of fundamental fairness. And that what's fundamentally unfair about this is that your characterization is not quite fair.
Okay.
And that is because, again, let's think about the history of this. The original claim is filed in July of 2013. In December of 2013, you pointed out, there's an amended claim. Mm-hmm. That puts the plaintiffs on notice of a particular theory. They rebut it with their expert report. Mm-hmm. For sure, they haven't done all the testing that they eventually do, but they have all this other evidence. It's not until January 11th of 2016 that the DEP comes in with their report.
Okay. And why was it? Why did it come so late? Sorry.
It's not a responding report. It's a brand new report on a different theory.
Well,
I haven't seen it, but
you're right. No,
so
you're
it's
right.
Not really a responding
well,
report
but
to
but
your
it's
expert
responding,
report.
But it's responding to this extent. The theory that they had proposed earlier, the historic fill theory, wasn't holding any water. So now they have, so it's responding to the extent that it comes up with a new theory that will allow them to deny this claim.
Right. It's a new report. It's not not responding to your expert, but rather a new report.
I don't disagree with that characterization.
Mr. Lesberg,
and then we don't have a chance to respond.
In terms of the lateness, the explanation that I saw in the record was that Dr. Stankin wanted to do a visual inspection of the property, interior. Yeah. But the report is focusing on test results from the outside boring. So what was the reason for the delay that's attributable to the necessary field inspection that had to take place?
Respectfully, Levesque, I think that's a question for them.
But nothing you can see in the record.
Nothing in the record. What I can tell you, though, is that beginning in August of 2015, there's scheduling efforts made to schedule the site visit. Some noise about how there was some delays in scheduling that. I don't think that the lower court ever resolved that. So
the inspection takes place when it does.
A week before.
How does it relate to the report's focus on the information from outside that they had all along?
It absolutely doesn't, which is why there was no excuse for the state to have delayed so long in providing their report. Or their change in theory. And so what I think is that as they near trial, they say, oh my gosh, we have this historic fill is not going to work. There's evidence that the site is not on historic fill. We know that naphthalene is not a product of historic fill. We better shift gears here. And so then they run out and get a report done. I think that's what happened, but I don't know, and I don't think that that's in the record. But I think the fundamental problem here, what makes this so unfair in a context where there really are very important public interests involved in terms of keeping our state clean and compensating people when they are subject to these sorts of disasters.
But can I ask a question? Because at the very end of the ALJ's decision, he said you failed to distinguish between post-act and pre-act discharge. and maybe you can help me with this. Assuming there was a discharge years earlier, because there were suggestions that there were discharges, and Superstorm Sandy now was able to wash these prior discharges after the act, and bring them onto your property. Do you fall within the relief provided under the Spill Act?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And Justice
Fernandez... And is that one of your theories?
So the opinion by Justice Fernandez-Vigna, I think, in Atlantic City versus Hunt, talks about what a discharge is. And it talks about the notion that the term discharge should be liberally construed to effectuate the remedial purposes of the act. But beyond that general proposition, what we know about discharges is that often the material is old. So if you have, for example, on property a tank that's been sitting there filled with hazardous substances for years and years, even since pre-spill, it doesn't become a spill until it, quote unquote, interacts with the environment. That's the language of the court's decision. And so it's at that point that you do have a discharge. That just goes to the question of discharge, which honestly was not where the parties were fighting here. The parties were fighting on pre or post, and because the rules required them to provide a reason, their argument that it was pre-spill act turned on two things. First, it turned on the idea that it was historic fill, which respectfully was rebutted. And second, because it turns on this idea of DAP that it accumulated at the bottom of the ocean.
There could have been other discharges other than DAP or historic fill that preceded the spill act.
Right.
Was a fate and transport analysis ever done?
Pardon me?
Was a fate and transport analysis ever done?
Not that I know of. But here's what we do know, which is before Sandy, these properties are clean and habitable. After Sandy, there's oil. Everybody sees the oil, whether it's the police, whether it's DEP, everybody sees this. We know that oil is a hazardous substance. That seems unrebutted and irrebuttable. But the findings
of the ALJ.
Well, I think the ALJ rebutted that which is irrebuttable. I mean, fundamentally, that reality though seems to have sort of gone by the boards here. I mean, the ALJ.
It really isn't real. I mean, we're talking about lay witnesses, and I include lawyers, most lawyers, except real experts on these issues in that category. Police officers. You may walk by a place and say there's there's oil on the ground, and but is that is it, those are observations that are made from by people who are not doing any chemical analysis.
And if that's all it was, Justice Patterson, I think I would have a weaker case. But you have in the record before you lots of observations by DEP personnel, not untrained people, DEP inspectors who go out there in the days following the spill and say they see oil. So it's I think respectfully that lay observations have some place in this analysis, and I think one of the problems with the AOJ's decision is it gives no credence to those. None whatsoever. It just says you need analytic testing, but it also ignores the DEP personnel. And the DEP personnel who testified said, we have every reason to trust those observations because those are good trained people. Now, granted, they're not chemists. They're not doing a chemical analysis. But again, the fundamental precept here is that all of the evidence should be considered, including those sorts of visual observations.
One last area. Time is running a little.
Yes.
Can you clarify for us what took place at the appellate division level? Because you're here advancing an argument based on due process.
Mm-hmm.
The APTIV addressed the two discovery rulings, if you will, talking about abuse of discretion.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a due process argument leveled at the appellate division level?
Yes, but I will be candid and tell you that the words due process were never used.
So you're asking, is it fair to say that you're refining an argument and asking us to rule on a theory that was not presented?
No, I think the theory was advanced. And I'll tell you in a minute what pages of the appellate division brief. But there's no question that the argument that it was unfair because of the moving of the goalposts and of the inability to rebut at the end was raised. The words due process were never raised, but that mere label is all that wasn't raised. In the appellate division briefs, and I'll get it to you, and if you wish, I can do that when I get up for a very brief rebuttal at the end, if I can do that.
I do have two
questions. I know I'm supposed to have requested that in advance.
I have two quick questions.
But
one is, your expert, Brown, did testify about his observations, correct?
He did.
Okay, so we don't just have lay observations, we have his observations.
You're right.
And also, I thought that the arbitrator, and I think the appellate division cited to it, said that one of the reasons they didn't let the rebuttal report in was because it was not a new theory.
Was that it was not a new theory?
And not a new theory. Isn't that one of the rationale that was used?
The rationale is that the testing should have been done anyway. It really
I
didn't.
But wasn't one of the statements that they made something to the effect that, well, this really was not a new theory?
I don't think they specifically said that, but if they did, it would have been untrue. And it was not until the expert report in January that this whole notion
of... Well, I'm not
of
disputing that. I'm just asking, I thought that was one of the rationale used either by the arbitrator or the appellate division in concluding that there was, that the rebuttal report would not come in. It was not a mistake, not an abuse of discretion, not to let it in.
There was not the contention that the DAP theory was not new. I mean, that was it was new, and I don't think there was I don't think any of the holding was based on the idea that it wasn't new. The court did hold, both courts, I think, is what you're alluding to, that it wouldn't have mattered, that either way the testing should have been done, and that was our burden, and we should have satisfied that burden by doing that testing. Now I don't need to get up. On pages 42 to 50 of the appellate division brief is where this whole issue of the what I've called the due process argument is raised. Again, candidly, the words due process aren't used, but the unfairness of it is pointed out, as it was also in limine motion that had been filed.
Assuming the rebuttal report should have come in, is your requested relief a new hearing?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Stoffer said that we're all on the same page. We'll give Mr. Lesberg 2 minutes for rebuttal if need be after. You're up next.
And Chief Justice, I'll waive my 5 minutes if I could just answer one question.
Come to the center, please, and to present your argument. Go ahead.
Chief Justice Ravner, Justices of the Court, may it please the Court. I'd like to pick up on a question Justice Albin asked about whether the excluded report was in evidence. It was not ultimately in evidence. It was marked as P15, on day one of the arbitration, and it's given to Judge McGill at that time, and Judge McGill reviews it.
Better keep your voice up.
Who reviewed it? I'm sorry?
Judge McGill, ALJ, yeah, acting as arbitrator, is provided with the what's ultimately excluded by him on day one of the hearing. On February 1, 2016, that report is marked as P15. And on February 2nd, there's no hearing that day, the state files its motion in limine. On February 3rd, what turns out to be day two of the hearing, there's a ruling on the motion in limine to strike this report, to exclude this report. And Judge McGill, ALJ McGill, acting as arbitrator, gives several reasons why this report is improper and cannot come in the record.
Now let's stop there for one second. Okay, I understand it's not marked into evidence, but the question is it now preserved for appellate review? It's been marked. Is there anything in the record to indicate that some appellate court wouldn't be able to review the rebuttal report to determine whether or not ALJ McGill exercised mistaken discretion?
There's enough on page 28 to 30 of the day two transcript where Judge McGill describes the report and why it's deficient. And it comes down, ultimately, there's several reasons, the most important of which is what's called the gas chromatogram GC fingerprint analysis. It's not signed, it's not certified, it's not rendered to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. We don't even have a name on that document.
Okay, let's stop. And forgive me for stopping at this point, and because I want you to continue to describe the report. But do you have any objection to this court, our court, reviewing the report independently?
I do not, because I believe this report does not carry the day. It never mentions Dr. Stenkin. It never mentions C9 to C21 aliphatics, the screening that Dr. Stenkin...
Your position is that the report's inadmissible on the merits of the report, that it's not, it's in that opinion. It's not based on scientific evidence, which is probative of the case, because we don't know who signed it, what the tests were. So that the lateness issue is one issue, procedural, but substantively, you believe the report, even if it was in, should have been barred?
Yes, both. And Judge McGill, ALJ McGill, goes
and
through all that.
Was there a 104 hearing on this report that was rejected by the ALJ?
There was not a 104 hearing on this report.
So it's given to the court right before day one of hearing, which you said was February 2nd?
Day one of the hearing was February 1st, 2016.
February 1st. February 2nd was the motion in limine, and then nothing happens on the hearing until May, and that's when the judge rules on the admissibility of this?
No, I think we're talking about different reports, Justice.
Okay.
I'm talking about the excluded rebuttal report,
right,
or what's called rebuttal report.
Were there consecutive days of hearing? Let me ask the question.
There was not. There was February 1st,
yeah,
3rd, 4th, and then I think you go to the 11th and later in February 2016.
When did the
record, 5-day hearing.
When did the record close?
March 15th, I think, at full submission of post-hearing briefing.
So the ruling on the report came in May after the record had closed?
No.
Wasn't the ruling on February 3rd?
I'm sorry. Judge McGill's ruling is on February 3rd.
Okay. I'm sorry.
What's the second day of the arbitration.
And just to be clear, you're telling this court, look for yourself at the report. It doesn't meet the threshold admissibility requirements for the reasons given by Judge McGill. Yes?
Yes.
And you'll make the report available to us?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. If asked by the clerk of the court.
Understood. and
we will talk about it.
And I think ultimately it is important because Dr. Stenkin is the only expert qualified in this matter on analytical chemistry and toxicology, and he's developed testing for oil spills throughout his career. And while Mr. Brown, their expert, is admitted in certain areas, he doesn't have that expertise. He relies on the lab, and he says that during hearing, you know, in the record, and he says, I do not refute the conclusions of Dr. Stenkin about C9 to C21 aliphatics. Mm-hmm. And that's what this comes down to. It's about proofs.
Well, the argument is that that's the only way to prove that it's oil, based upon the DEP's position, correct?
That's right. That's right.
Now,
because their claim is for oil from the start,
right,
3 years prior.
Right. Did the record in any way consider the fact that there was spill fund or other forms of oil reparation damages given out to properties surrounding the property that's an issue here?
Yes.
Okay. What was the DEP's position on that? Since the argument was that the water, the floodwaters that rose, I would assume, rather uniformly or, you know, in parallel form for one building to the next, didn't stop at the gate of one for some reason, did it?
There's testimony in the record, and there's a dispute, of course, about the weight of the circumstances of what's going on in Bayonne. We know there's flooding in Bayonne, and we know that the DEP acted down the block to remove surface soil, mm-hmm, scraping of surface soil to the tune of $15,000 of what was an oily substance, but that's not on these properties. And Mr. Pinto is clear about that during his testimony, that he needs to evaluate each claim and what's on that property for which they're seeking, in this case, $3 million to knock down their homes and rebuild them.
Well, the damage claim is not really what we're discussing at this point. But wasn't there observation of oil slick or traces of what appeared to be oil at a relatively uniform flood height that was on visual on cars and on outside of the buildings in this whole general area? What did DEP produce to respond to that?
Well, from the start, DEP goes out and inspects the properties in 2013. There's never short shrift given to this claim. DEP's evaluating the claim from the start. And Mr. Pinto's observations are he believes it's a bathtub ring of soil or dirt, but not oil, in his view. Folks at DEP are evaluating the lone six samples, that U.S. Masters has that are ever submitted here, and they believe that it's historic fill. In their view, all they're doing is looking at historic fill mapping and looking at the evidence of how Bayonne has been built, essentially, and historic fill is all through this area.
But I thought they moved off the historic fill to the DAP theory. And the discussion of the what kind of silt was on the interior of the walls of the property in issue here was what Dr. Stenkin was talking about in his testimony on May 17th, page 46 through 49. But then he shifts to discussion of the laboratory testing outside. And there is an argument by your adversary that that's where the ALJ made a substantive misstep in transporting Dr. Stenkin's discussion about what he thought he was observing on the interior wall to his theory of the outside borings.
Well, first on what's observed, we know that's a wash. You know, they have their expert and company folks inspect the site. They see and smell one thing. DEP is out there, they see and smell another thing. And Dr. Stenkin also went out there, and that's ultimately, quote unquote, this delay, mm-hmm, although the DEP's report was before the hearing, consistent with Judge McGill's instructions, pursuant and in compliance with OAL's order. Dr. Stenkin goes out to the property, and he describes wiping the wall, this bathtub ring,
right,
and to him it's silt. It's silty material, which ultimately supports the DAP theory. And ultimately, whether it's historic fill or DAP, it doesn't matter. So it's not oil.
So the ALJ has a slightly different DAP theory articulated at the bottom of page 18 of the ALJ's opinion. Is that supported by the record?
Yes, it is, Chief Justice.
Explain how.
The DAP theory espoused by Dr. Stankin describes atmospheric deposition of man-made particles throughout over 150 years, and that it can fall into waterways. That's in his testimony. And so perhaps not at that exact point in testimony does he say, oh, and that's the stuff that made it into these five properties that they own, but Judge McGill's listening to that testimony about DAP and ultimately, you know, credits that as the most reliable evidence before him and points out again that it comes down to the C9 to C21 aliphatics. It's not a single particular test. It's really not an accurate portrayal of what happened. There's evidence on both sides, and we know there's circumstances of oil in the area of East Bayonne.
Would you concede that the theory of the arbitrator's determination diverged from your expert's theory?
I don't agree with that.
You don't?
The ALJ's ultimate decision?
Yes, the scientific component of the ALJ's decision. Do you agree or disagree with the proposition that your expert's scientific theory, as stated in the report that was allowed in, and the scientific theory adopted by the ALJ were different?
I don't believe they're different.
You think they're the same?
I think Judge McGill extends and completes, well, it could have come from the silt within 5 to 20 feet of the water.
Well, let me picking up on Justice Patterson's question, I'm going to read to you from the bottom of page 19 of the ALJ's report. In view of the multiplicity of oil facilities in the area, it is reasonable to infer that there were many spills over the decades. Then he goes, under the circumstances, in all probability, events occurred as envisioned by Dr. Stankin. Forget about that second sentence. Let's go back to the first one. In view of the multiplicity of oil facilities in the area, it is reasonable to infer that there were many spills over the decades. So now let's hypothesize for the moment that these spills occurred post-spill act, not on this property, somewhere else, and as a result of Superstorm Sandy, they were carried onto this property. Would U.S. Masters be entitled to compensation under the Spill Act?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Pre-act discharge.
No, assume it's post-act. Assuming post, when was the act enacted?
Effective April 1st, 1977.
Okay, so now my hypothetical is going to say that there were discharges from these oil facilities onto properties, not onto the subject's property, after 1977. But as a result of Superstorm Sandy, they migrated onto Master's property. Would they be entitled to compensation under those circumstances?
A post-act discharge,
yeah,
getting moved around,
yeah,
later.
Right.
I don't know the answer to that. And
The reason why I asked that question is because that seems to be one of the points that the ALJ accepts. In view of the multiplicity of oil facilities in the area, it's reasonable to infer that there were many spills over the decades. Over the decades. So we're in 2019, and that goes back to, like, you know, it goes into the post-act spill period, right?
But, Justice Alvin, it's still their burden as claimant to show has the substance, it's been discharged, and it's a post-70.
I understand that it's their burden, but the ALJ himself has put on the record a reasonable explanation for oil to have gone on their property as a result of these other spills. Otherwise, I don't know why the ALJ would have even mentioned that line.
But based on the weight of the evidence, by preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not, they have not shown that any of that oil made it onto these five properties.
Doesn't the ALJ, in his opinion, say that he believes that it might have, but he just doesn't consider it recoverable. If it happened, as Justice Alvin says, after the 77, and it happens as the ALJ poses, then it would be covered because it would be a post-act discharge that came onto the land of the plaintiff here because of the Hurricane Sandy. So then it would be covered, would it not?
Potentially, but that's not what happened.
But he says it.
But we don't know that.
Yeah, because he says it's reasonable. Look, that sentence and the next sentence don't match up. But he does say it's reasonable to infer that there were many spills over the decades. Huh?
But the technical evidence here doesn't support their claim at the end of the day. That's what rises to the top above everything else. And that's within Judge McGill's discretion to do, to find what's the most reliable evidence. And more likely than not, it's not oil.
Did DEP change its defense midstream?
I don't believe so, Justice. From the start, we said you need to show that your properties have been impacted by hazardous substances. Yes, there's a notice of intent to deny, and then an amended notice of intent to deny, all the way going back to 2013. But our position is they knew from that point in time, DEP leaning towards denying this claim based on the sole six samples that were submitted to the department. And if you're a claimant for $3 million, I think the appropriate thing to do would have been go back and sample again and again, not wait until January 28th before February 1st hearing date 3 years later.
Can you respond more directly to the argument that is it being advanced that the goalposts were moved when we went from a historic fill theory to a DAP theory?
I don't. That again, the same answer in terms of again, it's their burden to show a post-spill act discharge. The department has said you have not done so, and that's always consistent with the notice of intent to deny, the amended notice of intent to deny. And Judge McGill agreed with that at OAL, and Judge Masano agreed with that in the appellate division.
Do you think it's a fair interpretation reading Judge McGill's opinion that he thought this was a pretty close case?
It could be. Unfortunately, the state sometimes loses those close cases when it's bringing spill out cases.
No, I'm not saying who should win and who should lose, but he thought it was a close case.
It could be, but ultimately, at the end of the day, lines need to be drawn in terms of when reports are submitted, and evidence will rise to the top, and the judge, the ALJ, is in the best position to hear the witnesses, to judge their credibility, and to consider the evidence.
In your experience with either in arbitrations or when cases reach court, is there a mechanism, because of the sort of the unusual burdens that occur here? Obviously, the NOI has to be done by the state to state the reasons for the denial. There's some open-ended language. You have the burden on the plaintiff who's making the claim to prove by preponderance the evidence. Is there a mechanism that judges or arbitrators use to just get everybody out there with their theories, either with a scheduling order or some method to prevent this kind of thing from happening?
Yes, the ALJ did set in place an order which said all discovery in this matter must be completed prior to the hearing.
Okay, but in terms of, is there anything else that you've seen that effectively gets everybody's theories, everybody with an expert schedule or something like that, that just gets in advance of the hearing, everybody's theories out there on the table?
Well, they should be pursuant to the spill fund arbitration rules, where it's a very detailed application process that the claimants must go through, and the department evaluates the claim, and I believe there's a provision in the regs that say, well, once it comes down to denial of the claim, that's when the record is closed. But the inference is, well, up until that time, there's going to be communications, which there were in this instance, between the department and the claimant.
What were the proofs on those $15,000 claims and the adjacent properties that were settled as opposed to the $3 million claim? Do you know?
What were the proofs?
Yeah, did they have experts that indicated that it was Superstorm Sandy that the deposits were on their property? Did they have any kind of experts on those smaller cases?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I'm not 100%
sure. What was the basis
sure.
for that you provided public money, our taxpayer money, to those cases without proof? What were the proofs that they had on the small cases?
Well, in this record, at 87 East 21st Street, about a block away, mm-hmm. There's observations in the yard of an oily substance.
Similar to the observations here?
I'm sorry?
Similar to the observations here?
No.
Was that the extent of the proofs?
That was the extent for the
small one?
The action. And it wasn't a claim for the record. It was the department's emergency response unit. They were doing lots of work throughout the state and in I would say, preventing future spill fund claims so that the homeowners didn't have to do those cleanups themselves and go through the claims process. So the department acted in response to Superstorm Sandy in many instances.
Mr. Stoff, I want to go back to the goalpost metaphor for a second and ask you to give us a little bit more. You said correctly that in the NOI, you found that the burden of proof had not been met. They haven't demonstrated hazardous discharge. And correct me if I'm wrong, one of the explanations was that what occurred was consistent with historic fill, not oil contamination. Was there anything about DAP in that denial?
I don't believe that there was, Your Honor.
So what do you say to their argument?
Well, that the initial paragraphs of the notice of intent to deny and amended notice of intent to deny all come down to you have not shown post-spill act discharge. So that's first and foremost what they're reading.
But then you give reasons.
Yes.
That do not include DAP.
Correct. This department staff is reviewing these claims, and what they looked at those historic fill maps, so I think that's what informed them initially. But even in this record, there's evidence of Dr. Sugihara and Kevin Schick of DEP helping the administrator consider this claim very seriously, and Dr. Sugihara has some questions about the aliphatics and about the fractionated, that there's no fractionated analysis in their six samples. There are only six samples from 2013.
But it was Stankin who came up with the theory of air pollution, correct?
Of
the DAP.
I don't know if it's just air pollution, but it's this diffuse anthropogenic
right.
pollution
coming
that's
from the atmosphere and landing in the water or on the ground. And that came up just weeks before the actual hearing, correct?
Correct.
And tell me if I'm mistaken about this. Your adversary called you sometime maybe in late January about what they expected to be in Brown's report, rebuttal report. Is that correct?
I'm not.
Either you or someone else.
I'll assume that's correct if Your Honor has that information.
I think it's in the record somewhere. I'm not just coming up with this.
Can I respond?
Cold with the results.
Can I respond
to
one point, though, Your Honor? Dr. Stankin's report, which we advised them that he had been in the process of preparing and was just waiting on a site inspection, not to take samples, but just so he can get the layout of the properties, and so he can see these properties and their interior. That report is provided on January 11th, and it's still 17 days later before all of a sudden they decide they want to take new samples. And they decided, we believe, because, well, they finally get the pre-hearing brief of the department and say, whoops, well, we better go out and do more sampling. So Stankin's report is January 11th, and they still waited over almost 3 weeks to go out and do more sampling.
Their argument is they had the same whoops that you had. You had your January 11th whoops, and then they had theirs several weeks later. Like you had, based upon their analytics, you still had the argument that they had to do retesting. The argument about stuff from the atmosphere coming down, that theory was available years earlier, correct? You didn't Brown didn't have to come up with that. Stankin didn't have to come up with that on January 11th. That theory was always there, correct?
We didn't know that, though, as the department, because we retained Dr. Stankin, and he reviews sandboard maps.
When did you retain him?
Approximately May or June, mid-year of 2015.
Right, so, I mean, that theory was always going to be a potential, correct? As long as you were not satisfied with the analytics from U.S. Masters, you had two theories. You had this historic fill, and Stankin also knew he had the DAP, which he could have provided to U.S. Masters back in 2015. No?
Well, we don't. He provides the report ultimately January 11th.
DAP wasn't something new that he had to do testing. That's just one theory for why these aliphates would appear in the ground, correct?
Correct. But ultimately, their analytics, their claim, they have to prove hazardous substance. They're saying they're the victims of the Bayonne oil spill.
The only reason why I'm raising this is because, you know, they're arguing, you know, you could have delivered your report, at least pieces of it, a lot earlier than January 11th. Do you agree?
That's possible. Yes, I'll agree that. Okay. But ultimately, our report was provided in advance of the report.
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lesberg. 2 minutes.
First of all, I think one fact that's important for the court to consider in terms of all of this timing is that while the report itself was not produced until February 1st, a summary of the report was submitted on January 29th. So before the commencement of the hearing, not only was there the phone call to which you alluded, but there was also a summary of the report, and this is in the record, that was provided at that time. Second, if I direct the court's attention to 556A of the appendix, and that captures the point that the state is making, which has to do with the fact that they slowly are coming to the conclusion that historic fill is not going to do it as a theory, and you see this in Dr. Sugihara, to which who's alluded to, an email from her where she's saying, "I'm not so sure about this historic fill thing," and so, you know, at that they then it takes a while for them to come around, but we don't have this. This is not provided until the middle of trial. So we were not on notice at all until January that the historic fill argument was not going to be their argument. And finally, I just want to reemphasize, the regs say that if the administrator denies the claims, the administrator has to provide a written statement setting forth the reasons. The reasons can't be denied. But this was worse. If they had just said denied, or if they had just said there's no hazardous spill, or if they had just said there's no post-spillac spill, then we would have known that the whole range of possibilities was open. Instead, they said it's historic fill. So that's what we addressed. There was no opportunity, for sure, to address the DAP theory until it was too late to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. And counsel, I know we talked about this during argument. Court will conference. What, if anything, to do about the report, and be in touch with you through the clerk. Anyone need a break?